Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Platypus, the extraordinary story of how a curious creature battled the world by a hidden treasure of Australia called Anne Morrell. She's written a brilliant little book bringing together some insight into this little furry animal. It's about the size of a mole, I suppose. It's the length of an A4 page. Beautiful, very soft fur, very shy, fast, agile animal, but an ancient animal in that it gives birth, rather than to young, it gives birth to eggs. And it's under the section of mammals. These are furred creatures which feed their young milk. There's placentals, which are you and me, the monkeys and things like that, and cows and dogs and cats. There's the marsupials, which are they're things like koalas and kangaroos and possums. They have little pouches. And then there's a final group of only two members called the monotremes, which means one whole, and they give birth to eggs, and that's the echidna, or the spiny anteater, which we have down in Australia, and the platypus. Both the echidna and the platypus have these soft, protruding, eating things, no true teeth. The echidna has a little extended long nose beak, which it sits into ant holes with a long tongue and whips things out. And the platypus has the same. So just to get into your overall view, there's invertebrates, which are the insects and worms and stuff like that. There's vertebrates, which have backbones. And under the vertebrates, there are fishes, reptiles, mammals, and birds. And in the mammals, it goes through these various forms. So the reptiles are cold-blooded fish, are cold-blooded worms. Sorry, not worms. Birds are warm-blooded. And these creatures here are warm-blooded, but just. You'll find that some of the larger reptiles are almost quasi-warm-blooded, like turtles. And so this chapter is called The Antipodes. So, which means the opposite end of the world. And his quote by, it starts off with a beautiful quote. Gerard Kereff, curator at the Australian Museum, Australian Vertebrates. Australia is a habitat of this curious creature. I'll just call it platypuses because I just went on the internet and I just got the Ornithochirus. I can't pronounce it, which, though plentiful, is still very little known. No further progress has been made towards the solution of this still pending and highly interesting physiological question. Does the platypus lay eggs? They weren't sure for a long time. And although I find it very rare, I've never seen a platypus alive in the bush. I've had people point out, say, look, this platypus is over there, but I've never seen them. They used to be incredibly bountiful, but they're not endangered at all in Australia. While Darwin moved the complex species of his biological mosaic into place across the 1840s and 50s, Richard Owen swung expansively. Now, I think Richard Owen... just going to get my memory correct on the various people I just really can't remember whether Owen's a creationist and all that type of stuff. Richard Owen swung expansively to his creative reconstruction of extinct birds and mammals from fragments of bones being dug up by collectors from strata around the world. At the same time, he maintained what had become his proprietorial interest in Australia's living fossils. Forever, the great Richard, as the Australian Museum creator rather impatiently called him. The solution of the platypus loomed as a clear classificatory question, as the central query of his unfolding of nature's plan. As a knowledge expert, Owen had summed up existing biological knowledge of the platypus in his essay on Monotrema in the Cyclopedia of Anatomy and Psychology in 1841. In his concise style, he noted that the monotremes present the extreme modifications of the implacental type, the mark, the last step of the transition from the mammalian to the oviparous classes, the egg-laying classes. His skills observing eye pinpointed the physical function and the appearance of the animal, opened largely from his own collections, the cranium, tongue, stomach, beak, glands, urogenital tract, and all other parts to view, and itemized its singularities. The animal glowed from the learned pages. The body is clothed with the dense coat of fur, Owen wrote, which consists of fine fur intermixed with long, stiff, flattened, and sharp-pointed hairs that seem to represent the spines of an echidna. So it's really amazing. That is true, that you can actually feel that in a platypus's fur. It's the feet are short, broad, there's a quote, the feet are short, broad, armed, each with a fine claw, but less robust than the echidna. The forefeet have webbed, which not only unites and fills the interstices of the toes, but extends beyond the extremities of the claw, and the web of the hind foot terminates in the base of the claws. With these swimming feet, this is associated with a strong, broad, horizontal, flattened bill, which completes the organic locomotive machinery for the aquatic existence of an air-breathing, warm-blooded quadruped. He was the master's word portrait of an animal he judged to be a vital connecting link between the mammal and the bird. There were gaps in the knowledge of some of its functions. The horny pointed spur on the heel of the male, a feature shared with the monotremes, the echidna, was such one. Anomalous like other features of the animal, its suspected use as an offensive weapon, which Bennett, for one, questioned, had yet been proved. Above all, the mode of generation and course development of the monotrema, quote, although elucidated in many essential points by the light of anatomy and analogy, he observed required observation of the breeding animals and the impregnated uterus, the utero and embryo in several stages before he can be fully determined. On the metropolitan cusp of the northern hemisphere, far from the animal's preserve, it was a point Owen was prone to repeat. Yet little enough was happening in the colonies. Bennett, taken up with his rising medical practice and work at the Colonial Museum, was no longer in the field. Owen must stir other pots. In the early 1840s, he turned to the Adjutant Surveyor General Thomas Mitchell, known to him from the Wellington Caves fossils, and flattered him with an invitation to assist in the course of his inland surveys to solve some of the most puzzling enigmas in physiology. It was a full assignment. A female platypus, the distant scientist specified, should be shot and pickled every week during the months of September, October and November. 100 would not be too many, he urged, if he could thereby settle the long disputed question, oviparous, oviviparous, or viparous, that is, egg-laying, egg in the belly, or live. A hole should be cut in the belly, his instructions ran, and spirit thrown in, and then she should be placed in spirit's bodily, if the keg is 2/3 or more filled by specimens. Gosh, this is incredible. There's George Bennett. The spirit should be changed once or twice a week before they are fully packed off. Otherwise, it becomes too weak to preserve the internal parts necessary to be dissected for purposes of inquiry. But events hastened slowly in the colonies. Mitchell's next major survey in 1845 took him away from the platypus country to the dry region of northern Queensland. A decade later, confined by administrative work in Sydney, the Surveyor General was dead. Well, and can I just say, there's a little bridge just at the back of Glenbrook called Mitchell's Pass after this surveyor, Mr. Mitchell. And it's the oldest bridge, land bridge in Australia, down across the little creek at the back of our property, or the back of our Glenbrook. It fell instead to the ornithologist and zoologist John Gould on the 18-month visit to Australia in 1838-40 to inspect and report on animal that still held London's scientific world enthralled. Gould, a skillful organiser, something of a British Audubon, was about to blend science with the marketplace. Trained as a taxidermist, he had already achieved notice as the writer of Birds from the Himalayan Mountains and Birds of Europe before he ventured to the Antipodes, which means Australia. Short, cheerfully, immaculately dressed in a black suit and a top hat, with his gun and collecting bag slung across his arm, he travelled from Tasmania to South Australia and then to New South Wales, employed other collectors to extend his wide collecting net. Working rapidly, he gathered a mass of information on the habits, economy and appearance of the colony's birds and mammals. Birds he gave to his gentle illustrator wife, Elizabeth, to draw and paint with elegant accuracy while made rough sketches of the mammals and preserved their skins for precise depiction and engraving by a team of artists and the publishing enterprise he had set up on his return to London. Oh, Gould's Finch, I think it would be. Is that Gould? We've got a Gould's, couple of Gould's birds. I wonder if that's to do with him. In his Introduction to Mammals of Australia, Gould described his first close encounter with monotremes. Tired by a long and laborious day's work under the burning sun, he wrote, I frequently encamped for the night by the site of a river, a natural pond, a waterhole, and before retiring to rest, not infrequently sketched my weary body on the riverbank, while thus reposing the surface of the water, often disturbed by little concentric circles formed by the platypus, or perhaps an echidna came trotting towards me. I do trot echidnas. Oh, there's Gould. What a shooter. My God. His more formal account in his Mammals of Australia, which he published 13 parts, studded with beautiful colour illustrations in the years 1845-63, there reflecting on Australia's paradoxical creations in 63, he noted that, quote, unquestionably the most singular anomalous of all animals was the platypus. I'm going to try and pronounce the Orthonotaurus. It's got a word, a zing to it, which has got nothing of the letters. I don't know how they pronounce them. With the habits and economy of which, as well as the mode of reproduction, we are even now, after an interval of 55 years since its discovery, but imperfectly acquainted. Gould had digested Owen's writing on the platypus's anatomy and physiology and soaked up Bennett's eyewitness account. Nevertheless, he was well aware that much more remained to be made known about this extraordinary type among quadrupeds. So what's your... David Ambrose has got a brilliant documentary where he actually has a camera and watches them give birth. You know, a little infrared camera. It's pretty amazing. From his own observations, the specimen received from other places, Gould recorded its presence in Tasmania and eastern Australia from Port Phillip to Moreton Bay, in the streams and rivers flowing on both sides of the mountain ranges, and the tributaries of the Murray and Darling rivers. But his news was gloomy on the sites nearer the settlement of Sydney. In the Hawkesbury and the Hunter rivers there was, he recalled, a diminution of platypus numbers due to the wholesale destruction dealt out by settlers, which, if not restrained, will ere long lead to the expiration of this harmless, inoffensive animal. That's true, I can't find them around here, although there are some in the river. It was, Gould said, often killed for the mere wantonness or almost for no useful purpose than to make slippers of its skin. Gould's observations were sharp and well-informed, writing for the generation, for the general reader rather than the scientific naturalist. His aim was to show that each great division of the globe had its own peculiar forms of animal life, and that the fauna of Australia was wildly different from that of every other part of the world. Quote, to account for these specific principles, he admitted, writing before Darwin's thoughts were published. Would be very difficult, though he observed the law of representation was widely apparent among her mammals. The law of representation, I don't quite understand what that means. While the practical Google avoided theory, he inclined to the view, drawing on his knowledge of the marsupials, that the platypus was oviviparous, that means had an egg but gave live young. On my returning from Australia, he reported, in the Mammals of Australia, the venerable Geoffroy St. Hilaire put the following question to me. Question, does the platypus lay eggs? And when I answered in the negative, the fine old gentleman and the eminent naturalist appeared somewhat disconcerted. Now, this omniforous notion, Gould went on, was nearly in accordance with the true state of things, somewhat akin to what is actually the case. I consider the most striking peculiarity of the singular animal, and indeed of all the marsupia, to be in perfectly formed state in which the young are born. Here's a quote from the book. The kangaroo at its birth is not larger than a baby's little finger. It's really small. The small kangaroos are really small. They crawl up the pouch. It's not very unlike it in shape, and is extremely helpless state. The mother, by some means at present unknown, places the vermiform object on one of its nipples. So it takes about 3 hours to crawl from the birth canal right up into the pouch. The mother licking it the whole time. By some equally unknown process, the little creature becomes attached to the attached by its imperfectly formed mouth to a nipple, and there remains dangling for days and even weeks, during which it gradually assumes the likeness and structure of its parents. At length, it drops from the lateral attachment into the pouch. Oh well. That's actually, if I can tell you, the actual kangaroo nipples at the base of the pouch. Reattaches itself as hunger prompts it on, so to, and often tumbles off when it wants to have, once its wants have been supplied. Well, the nipple of the kangaroo is at the bottom of the pouch. I don't understand what he's talking about. Oviviparity of the platypus, Gould assumed, would produce young which were recognised as being a little more than embryonic form. This, so he just transplanted the kangaroo onto the platypus. This, he concluded roundly, echoing the theorists like Owen and others had asserted years before, is a very low form of animal life, indeed the lowest among mammalia, and exhibits the first stage beyond the development of a bird. Gould's research of the Australian mammals, with its beautifully depicted, now famous illustration, and his detailed notes on each mammal, issued in parts across nearly 20 years, marked the first attempt to bring these unique fauna collectively under public review. While there was some murmuring among London's scientific elite, Gould marketed his lavish productions, and that he, quote, Not Quite a Scientific Man is superb books sold and carried an eyewitness account of the elaborate depiction of the popular platypus to a wider world. While Gould charmed the British readers with his representations of the platypus and canvassed the oviviparous birth, that's the egg hatching inside the mother, in Australia at the turn of the half century, and anonymous poems called Land Contraries publicly proclaimed a different generative code. There is a land, this is the poem, there is a land in distant seas full of contrarieties. The beasts have mallards, bills and legs, have spurs like cocks and lay hens like eggs. But where was the proof? No definitive evidence of an egg travelled back to the anatomists and theorists in Britain and... and Europe. Moreover, by 1850, the original creed protagonists in the platypus mystery were dead. Lamarck in 1829, Everett Home and Cuvier in 1832, Meckel in 1833, the controversial Geoffroy in 1844, Blanville in 1850. The younger Owen was now undisputed principal of comparative anatomy, inherited the systematist's unwanted and unanswered questions. Owen, however, was balked by scientific science in the colonies. Despite his appeals and overtures, return on the monitorings was scant. Members of the lively Tasmanian Society of Natural History furnished nil returns. The Tasmanian Journal of Natural Science, under the apt platypus crest and motto, shone in the years 1842-46. Was as one of the scientific journals of the Australian colonies, but Owens published a plea to members inviting them to round up and pickle impregnated female specimens of the animals for dispatch to him in London, was the only reference to the platypus in the journal. The self-declared Polish count and naturalist, Paul de Strzelecki, so we have Strzelecki, Rangers in the back of Melbourne, traversing New South Wales and Victorian Eastern's flank, threw his hat into the ring, noting in his account of the region's zoology in 1848 that the striking and wonderful peculiarities of the external internal organisation distinguished them. He observed in the case of the duck-billed platypus, however, covered as it was with the fur, moving on four webbed feet, suckling its young, it was most probably Vivi gave birth to lifelong young and had been discovered in the process of a series of contrivances by which it was fitted to live equally well in the elements proper to two distinct classes of animals. This creature, a world of wonders in itself, said Strzelecki, with a respectful nod to the preeminent savant, has been founded by Professor Owen to approximate the reptiles in its generative system. Both viviparity and oviparity remained on the cards. So it's live birth or egg hatching in and live birth. British opinion in the scientific matter held the lead, but the French maintained alert. During the 1840s, Mr. Jules Verreaux, one of the special brand of naturalist voyageurs from the National Museum of Zoology in Paris, trained and sent forth to different parts of the world to collect mammals for France's scientific museums, arrived in Australia with a platypus particularly in mind. Verreaux spent several years in the colonies and for some 15 months studied the habits of the platypus in Tasmania. He found them abundant in the rivers of New Fork, and killed several with the high altitude of Mount Wellington near Hobart. The French, to his bootstraps, is the first to record the manner of the platypus coitus. This is lovemaking, I suppose. During the months of the 1st of September, I came to discover the coupling took place in the water, carefully hidden under the expressly made canopy, and in the depths of which it was necessary for me to stay the entire nights without daring to move, for the platypus is extremely distressful nature. I was able to follow its all its movements. The male, having followed the female for more than an hour, always finished by leading her to the middle of the reeds, there, clinging firmly with the help of his beak, he held strongly on the skin of her neck while applying spurs to the serous part. The female, while struggling energetically, would swim and utter plaintive squeals before which bore some semblance to those which bore some resemblance to those of a little a pig, and which were ever increasing. The coupling lasted 5 or 6 minutes, and then the two animals would play together for more than an hour. Now, that's the author translating directly from the French. Verreaux also cast refreshing lights on the early development of the embryonic young and gave the first recorded record of young platypuses suckling in the wild. At the end of 15 to 20 days, he relayed, the once naked young are covered with silky fair hair and able to swim. Their beak, he said, did not at all recall the form that of the adult, but was short, broad, and thick, and could embrace the embrace in that state the mammary areola concealed by the hairs of the mother. When they suckled, his acute eye discerned they continually titurated the mother's belly with the 4 feet. Watching them play with their mothers at some distance from the bank, he distinguished that when they wished to procure nourishment, they profited by movement. The mother was among the aquatic plants, and where there was no current. The female, having her back exposed on the exercise of a strong pressure, the milk would float to a little distance, and the young might suck it up with facility. This it does, turning about so as to lose as little as possible. I have witnessed this fact repeatedly, both daily and nightly, Verreaux wrote. I've also remarked that the young, when fatigued, climb upon the back of the mother, who brought it to the land where it caressed her. Throughout, this has been amazing, that the little platypus puglets sit on the back of the platypus. Throughout his Tasmania sojourn, the French naturalist had, more than any previous reporters, observed a considerable number of young and adult platypuses in their natural habitat. Returning to Paris in 1848, with an assorted collection of Australian fauna, he published his observations in the Revue Zoologique. Not surprisingly, Owen seized on Verreaux's paper and translated in part of this paper, Remarks on the Observations sur le Platypus, par Jules Verne, which he published that year. Wet, but observant among the reeds and rivers, Verreaux had proved an astute field observer, but to an English scientist's disappointment, he had failed to produce a fetus in utero as an ultimate proof of the animal's generation. While Owen, from his own long dissecting experience, clearly favoured the platypus's ovivar parity, which means giving birth to the live by an egg, the Frenchman's evidence was very welcome. Quote, the number of platypuses which I have processed, Verreaux wrote, has perfectly demonstrated to me that the animal does not lay eggs, as it has been supposed, but is oviviparous. The ovira, which form part of my collections, are sufficient to prove that. Science, however, waited for decisive answers. The wait was already long, yet for proprietor Owen, his own recourse was to repeat his request to the Tasmanian naturalist for an impregnant uterine, a female killed at different periods and at after the stage of development, asking them to send the hindered half, the hinder half of specimens to London. He would wait in vain for such hinder halves from the island that sat like a full point at the question mark below the Australian continent. Oh, is that beautiful? It does look like a full point of a question mark. There was a small flurry of action in New South Wales in 1850. Scientist P.P. King entrusted several platypus specimens to the care of young Thomas Henry Huxley, who, at the onset of his brilliant biological career, had been stationed in Sydney Harbour as surgeon and naturalist of the HMS Rattlesnake, and was about to sail home following the ship's four-year survey of Australian waters. From 1855 to 57, Owen also received two consignments of three female platypuses from a Melbourne residence, J.S. Dismore, although obtaining impregnated specimens and obliging colonists confided was particularly difficult. In 1858 came Domino's tired disclaimer that he could procure no more. But in 1864, Owen was no longer stalled by silence. In that year, a Victorian physician forwarded him an account that of a recently captured platypus had laid two eggs. Owen reacted dismissively, much as he had done 30 years before over the account of an eggshell and debris of the platypus nest described to him by Lieutenant Moule. Then he had been gratified by suggestions that the monitorings gave milk. As Moule advanced in his report in the following mammary glands, but he chose to dismiss the reported eggshell as excrement coated with urine salts. The trauma of capture, Owen had said, on this occasion may have caused the female platypus to abort spontaneously. 60 years into the platypus mystery, Owen was caught in a paradigm. It was a paradigm largely of his own making. With no other researchers challenging his opinions, the oviparous generation of the platypus was judged to be an accepted truth. For Owen, Gannell's oviparous made the mode of birth would establish the platypus in its true taxonomic position between reptile and mammal. Essentially, he looked to the colonies to give his judgment the final tap of truth. In the event, a key battle in the conceptual war on species and their place in nature would be fought not in the scientific collecting grounds of Australia, but in the realm of the philosophical debate in Britain. Clash of the Titans, Chapter 10. Quote, by a book called Does the Platypus Lay Eggs? And this is Clash of Titans. At every significant step along the way, in the solving of a puzzle, the obvious signposts were misread, and misread from maps which themselves were already out of date. By the 1850s, Owen's reputation was second to none in the biological capital. His industry was enormous. He had published widely on monotremes, marsupials, Darwin's South American fossils, New Zealand males, a large recent book on teeth, works on the nature of limbs, anatomy and fishes. He was deeply involved in the study of fossils garnered from the imperial outposts around the world. This is interesting. This is a world before internet where people could be great experts. We now have Google, I suppose. While his long tapering hands reached deeply into the arcane fields of the fossil world, Owen's evening lectures, which were delivered each year at Professor of the Hunterian Museum, blazed across the grand sweep of natural history and were attended by large, eager audiences. And this is interesting, this audience public lecture theatre is also how Faraday came across. This is about the time, a bit after the time of Faraday. These public lectures were a major thing in Britain, British science. And I suppose podcasts now are taking the place of these scientific lectures. In 1841, this buoyant scientist had coined the term dinosaur. Well, there you go, Owen Dinosaur. Conceiving the great reptile as next to the mammals in life scale, the highest of the reptiles, and equipped it with a perfect circulatory system of four chambers heart. Why you did that one. On the crest of the Victorian admiration for his awesome fossil reconstructions, he transformed his paleontological findings into a series of spectacular cement models of giant extinct mammals, which were erected in the Crystal Palace Gardens of London's exhibition in 1854. Before the fascinated gaze of the press and the public, Owen and his 21 guests sat down to dinner on the model of the Iguanodon. Whoa! That's just weird. They actually built a dining room in a dinosaur. A dinosaur dining room. I like it. In 1856, the authoritative Olympian figure, he took up the appointment as head of the Natural History Department at the British Museum. In a world where the new philosophical ideas were shaping, Owen was the voice of the Anglican science, and it's really true that you had to be an Anglican to be in the scientific community. He hobnobbed with the bishops and politicians, was the darling of the dukes and aristocrats. Prince Albert cultivated him and invited him to Windsor Castle to lecture to the royal children on natural history. The Queen, Victoria, granted him a royal house in Richmond Park, where he lived out his long and active life. Owen's philosophical concepts were firmly drawn. He believes in the live birth of the platypus. He had early espoused the view of the archetype in the vertebrate history and the primal pattern in which all vertebrates were based, upon which the cavalcade of fossils emerging from the earth's strata confirmed. From his ranging works on fossil forms, he judged the extinction of species went hand in hand with the progressive creation which had continued to furnish a succession of species in which the architects were preserved. By contrast, Lamarck's evolutionary progressionism was an abomination to him, which of course Darwin sort of cruised up in the middle. So Lamarck's the French person, and of course it's hard for you, I've sort of read right through Lamarck's work. Owen might jettison fixity of species, but he stoutly rejected transmutations. In sum, he believed that each species had been created but once at one time and place, but there was secondary natural law at work in how allowing for an adaptive progression of species. On the mechanisms of this adaptation, he was notably less to say, but he attributed it to the evidence of the creative foresight and to the ordained continuous becoming. So you've got the catastrophism, and then this is progressive creation. So he's in the Cuvier idea that God says, well, here's a couple of dinosaurs for you. And his loss in his lofty position of power and authority, men turned to him for his judgment as challenging new ideas of evolution swirled around the London scene. His opinion, with its strong moral overtones, carried weight. When the controversial, semi-scientific, philosophical work, The Vestiges of Creation, which is the one that he hated, that's the one that scared Darwin out, published anonymously by Robert Chambers, stirred the public as a 7 rapid-fire editions went to print in 1844. Owen praised it privately to the author for its definition of higher generative law. in explaining changes of species, but hurled his strength in public against any argument that linked organic advancement to man. So this Vestiges of Creation was a pre-Darwin one, and it was Owen went against it so vehemently that Darwin hid for years. Owen allotted man a subclass of his own to this preeminent autonomous who enjoyed the privilege of dissecting deceased apes and chimpanzees from the London Zoo, the man who descended from their kind, quote, he was as different from the chimpanzee, Owen proclaimed in 1857, as the ape was from the platypus. There you go. I wonder, mused Darwin, in the privacy of his Sussex home, what chimpanzee would say of this. The mean words, he was, oh, it's not beautiful. But the platypus got in the main debate. Darwin's working on his own time without public position was constructing a very different view. His concept of a common descent by modification of species and the existence of a single centre of Pacific origin with the Australian marsupial and monotremes as a case in point, and subsequent migration and colonisation was a far cry from Owen's prescribed world with its successive creation spurred by a generative but divinely initiated second cause. So you've got the first creation, the first cause, which is from Aristotle and Plato, the prime mover, and now he's saying, well, Owen's saying there's a second set of generation. Initially, when Owen first met and classified Darwin's South Australian fossils, the two men's friendship grew. Darwin, Voyages of the Beagle, Owen wrote, the young traveller on his publication, was as full of good original wholesome food as an egg. But a growing arrogance and coldness on Owen's part weakened the ties. The underset of Darwin, a child, as the observer put it, could talk to that man, or was drawn instead to a band of younger scientists appearing on the London scene. Joseph Hooker and Thomas Huxley, influenced by the adventurous voyages of survey and exploration of the Southern Hemisphere, of a congenial company. For Hooker, Darwin was a touchstone. Even before serving off early in 1840 as assistant surgeon to the botanist in the HMS Erebus on the British Antarctic expedition, I remember that, to Australian and Antarctic workers, he had slept with the proofs of Darwin's Voyage of the Beagle lent to his father by Lyell under his pillow. No more instructive and inspiring work, he wrote later, occupy the bookshelf of my narrow quarters throughout the voyage. During his time in Tasmania, collecting plants on his famous Tasmanian flowers, Joseph Hooker grasped the exceptional nature and distribution of Australian flora and started on the slow change from the initial belief in mounting groundswell of opinion against the powerful autonomous. So Owen's on the nose. Owen is both feared and hated, he wrote in a letter in 1851, a year after his return to England. With W.S. Macleay, the distinguished British systematist who is now living in New South Wales. Quote, it's astonishing with what intense feelings Owen is regarded by the majority of his contemporaries. Looking down from a great height, proud and egotistical, Owen, for all his authority and prestige, was fast becoming the most unpopular scientist in the kingdom. He was also moving out of his scientific limb. Working brilliantly from bone to bone, he was technically immensely knowledgeable, but as sharp as young Huxley saw it, in abstract reasoning, he becomes lost. There you go. Isn't that beautiful? Unlike Darwin, Owen's knowledge of the Australian species failed to fertilise his concept of the that the question of questions species changed. So let me read that one again. Unlike Darwin, Owen's knowledge of the Australian species failed to fertilise his concept of that question of questions species changed. I don't quite understand that one. In an address to the British Association in the early, so it might have been the British Association for the Advancement of Science, perhaps, but this is just the British Association in the early 1840s, he noted that Australia's fossil record had begun to yield evidence of correspondence between its latest extinct and present mammalian fauna. In fact, he said, quote, the more interesting on the account of the very peculiar organisation of most of the native quadrupeds of that division of the globe. However, he excluded this evidence of the variation of species and their concentration in a particular geographic area from any overall consideration of adaptive organic advance. So he was aware of the Australian fossil, you know, dinosaur kangaroos, giant wombats and stuff like that they were finding, but he just didn't put it together, which is, he was not capable of abstract thought. Although ready to adopt the notion that of the, quote, succession of types, a phrase that he would later claim, quote, to Darwin's irritation to be his own, Owen utterly repudiated evolutionary thought. Yet, for all his erudication, he could offer no mechanism for the progression of species. He clung instead to environmental factors as a key to species change. And when, which is like Lamarckian, and when, in 1859, he advanced the thesis that these were was some special factor of the Australian environment that made this uniquely suited to marsupials, Darwin, who knew of similar conditions for marsupials in Brazil, saw Owen's gigantic hallucination. There you go. Isn't that beautiful? He's a gigantic hallucination. And so it's just the greatest Owen versus Darwin. With the publication of The Origin of Species, Darwin found Owen his most bitter foe. Darwin offering was no longer seen as wholesome food, but has become the devil's disciple. In a series of readily identifiable anonymous reviews, Owen fiercely rejected the mechanism of natural selection in the evolution of organic species, referred with scorn to Darwin's, quote, ingenious suppositions, ignored his scrupulous building of factual datum, and castigated the theorizing of his work. Quote, one of my chief enemies, Darwin wrote sadly in his diary, his diary's got a capital D because it's a special book, with rare censure, the sole one who has annoyed me. Significantly, the platypus and echidna, so presenting a singular in Owen's physiological and morphological research, failed to penetrate his analysis of nature's law. So Owen just rejected it. I just can't deal with it. And, you know, it's definitely, you know, giving birth to live young, laying eggs. Significantly, by contrast, Darwin had explained with great a string of previously inexplicable facts, and swung his lens on species around the globe. His first edition, The Origin of Species, sold out within a week. The second edition was rushed out to waiting readers in January 1860. Yet, even within days of its first publication, Darwin's interpretations and thoughts had turned again to the monotremes. He returned to them in private correspondence more than any other. Darwin wished to bring the anti-progressionist and creationist Charles Lyell, the man he dubbed my Lord High Chancellor of Natural Science, into his evolutionary camp. Their letters, questioning and friendly, sped through the mail. Lyell inferred progression in Darwin's theory of evolution. Not so, said Darwin. I don't understand that. I think Darwin is in progression. Oh, right. Natural selection did not imply a necessary tendency to progression. According to the progressive theory, he responded, why there be a living platypus platypus. There is no ancestral platypus fossils of an evolutionary or synthetic kind, and if they should be found, they have escaped being altered, improved, and speciated in 30 periods. I don't quite understand. I can't read that one again. Natural selection did not imply a necessary tendency to progression. According to the progressive theory, he responded, why should there be a living platypus? There are no ancestral platypus fossils of the elementary or synthetic kind, and if they should be found, how have they escaped being altered, improved, and specialized in 30 periods? I don't know what that means. Working through the origin, Lyell pressed his old argument for the concept of separate creations, or at least primeval creative power that did not act with uniformity to explain links between distinct genera. Darwin was blunt. So it's interesting that Lyell inspired Darwin, and when Darwin comes back to write to Lyell, he's still a creationist. From the homologues, he replied to his doubting friend in September 1860. Quote, this is from Darwin. And so there's actually a three-way go. There's Owen, Lyell, and Darwin. It is the Clash of Titans. I should look at it as certain that all mammals had descended from some single progenitor. What's nature was is impossible to speculate. More like, probably, the platypus or the echidna than any known form. As these mammals combine reptilian character and a lesser degree bird character with mammals, we might give to the bird the habits of a mammal, but the inheritance would retain most eternity some bird-like structure and present the new creature ranking as a true mammal. So this is actually saying that when pushed behind, Darwin, arguing with Lyell, used the platypus. Sorry, I'm not reading this as well. Getting a bit late at night. A few days later, as Lyell wrestled with his case against natural selection, Darwin hammered his point. I quite agree with you on the strange and inflexible facts of the platypus having been preserved. I always repeat to myself that we hardly know why any one single species is rare or common in the best known countries. Yet, he mused in his letter to Lyell on the 23rd of September 1860, that while he knew, quote, of no animal of a grade or organization intermediately between animals, fish, and reptiles, whence the new mammal could be developed, that this unknown form and improbably related to the platypus than any other known form. So I'm finding it hard to read at this time of night, but it turns out that this little platypus has been key in Darwin's, when it all spills out, Darwin relies on the platypus to argue his way through the origin of the species. So this is, it's impossible to argue. He's got the letters between Darwin and someone who isn't Owen, which is Lyle. And so I think Lyle's saying the platypus is not back in history, it's here with us now. Darwin says spirited commentary brought results, as he had long hoped. Hooker, Huxley, and eventually Lyle came into his cause, helped by the platypus. Good on your platypus. And Darwin felt that while all the world might rail, his case was safe. The theory of natural selection would prevail. So the platypus saved Darwin. Oh, there you go. The clever Huxley would have the last word on the irony of science. The ablest of men, he reflected, was the product of his time, quote, profiting from one set of influences limited by another. Such was the brilliant and powerful Owen. His creative scientific memoirs opened up new worlds. His inflexible Anglicanism and establishment attitudes fossilized his philosophical conceptual views. Oh, isn't that great? This is brilliant. This is Anne Morrill is saying he's a fossilized person, but the real fossil was his views. Isn't that just such a rich intellectual thing, this author? This is one of the great thinkers of Australia, just been sidelined. But she's a great thinker, saying that Owen himself was the fossil. Let me see. His outliving his rival, Owen fought publicly to avert Darwin's internment at the burial in the Devil's Chaplain, burial of the Devil's Chaplain in Westminster Abbey in 1882. Well, there you go. That's so rich. I don't want to, you know, bury someone. That's amazing. Without success, tourists of every creed and kind now troop to stand beside Charles Owen's polished brass memorial wedged in the Abbey floor, while his books continue to fertilize biological and social thinking into 21st century. By contrast, the once courted and publicly honored Sir Richard Owen has forfeited much of his scientific influence by the time of his death in 1892. Isn't that most brilliantly put together book? So brilliant. I mean, I'm tired and reading. I wish I could pronounce the word. Word platypus. But what a brilliant, brilliant book. I wish I was awake enough to read it all. But I'm sorry I've read it so slowly and so hard. But I was really trying to understand it as I was reading. But at the end, if we can summarise again, this brilliant Anne Morrill has said that for all putting together fossils and all rejecting evolution, that Owen is actually a fossilized idea. He's actually an intellectual dinosaur. And the sort of pettiness that comes out of him is just amazing. And Anglican and British. That Lyle, this beautiful, beautiful thing, because Lyle so inspired Darwin, and then at the end they had a debate about the platypus, and the platypus got Lyle across and got Darwin safe and home and hosed. So he was rejected at his age, but the platypus came to his aid. Okay, we're up to page 141 and Solving the Mystery, chapter 11, and there's just, I don't know, this just goes on. This gets a brilliant, brilliant book. I can't describe how brilliant it's going to be. It just keeps on going. Just pretty amazing. And this is such a high quality book. And it's not celebrated in Australia. And this person is not very well known. Anne Morrill, you wouldn't know, but I think she is a genius. She's still in Canberra at 92. And, yeah, just a great, great book. Great, great read. Thanks for listening.
podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.